Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight we will go back in time to seasons past, when 22 men graced the rugged fields of yesterday, fighting for one more first down, one more yard gain, one final score that bring victory after 60 minutes of battle on the gridiron. Tonight we will explore the world of gridiron greats. Welcome to Gridiron Greats Football History and its memorabilia on the Gridiron Greats Publishing and Broadcasting Network, in conjunction with Slick Enterprises. We're live from the Wallingford, Connecticut home of Gridiron Greats Magazine. I'm Bob Slick, publisher and editor of Gridiron Greats Magazine, and I'll be your host for the show. Gridiron Greats is the only publication in America that focuses upon the history and memorabilia of the North American football game since its inception in 1869. We cover 140-plus years of football history and memorabilia, and you can find us on the web at gridirongreatsmagazine.com. We're sponsored in part by MSB Sports Cards. Check out their website for one of the largest selections on the web of football cards and football memorabilia at msbsportscards.com. And we're also sponsored by DST Auctions. Check out their website and their upcoming fall auction, dstauctions.com. Make sure you register for this upcoming fall auction. It's going to be incredible. At this time, I'd like to introduce my co-host, who is a senior contributing writer to Gridiron Greats Magazine, a football memorabilia historian specializing in pre-World War II items, in particular Red Grange, and also Seattle Seahawk items, in particular Steve Larger. He hails across the country from Portland, Oregon, Joe Squires. Joe, welcome to the show this afternoon.
Captain, good afternoon. So happy to be here. I still can't but help but chuckle several times during the intro. First of all, your football, you know, I absolutely love that. It gives me goosebumps every time I hear it. And then
it
also
is,
hearing
Red Grange, the football,
and hearing Red Grange and Steve Largent in the same sentence. So I love it.
Sure. Joe, I heard off football just a second. I heard you were in the path of the eclipse, and you were taking photographs of it as it was going by you in Oregon. There, is that true or false?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I mean, there was a spot in, you know, the eclipse went right through the middle of Oregon. And I traveled down to Southeast Oregon to see it for, you know, spent 3 days and lots of money to go stay at a place for, you know, 2 minutes worth of night. But I mean, I remember when the last one came around, I was, you know, 9 years old in second grade, and I just had to see it. And well worth it. Well worth it, sir.
Very good. Very good. We only had a partial eclipse here, and it was not as pronounced as other parts of the country, but it was very interesting, to say the least. Well, we're going to switch gears, get back to football here. A lot has happened since the last show. I did, for our listeners, a live show from the National. I did a 30-minute update of what was going on there, what I saw, different items, different pieces that I saw. I know, Joe, you weren't able to come to the National, and it was very interesting. It was very much same yet different, if you know what I mean. I saw stuff that I saw at the last National there. I saw a lot of new stuff. I'm very surprised that if that National show was ever done on a second floor, the weight of the plastic slabs would probably break it and bring it down to the first floor. That's my honest opinion.
Yeah.
And I still maintain I should have bought plastic stock 5-10 years ago. But in any event, there was a lot of interesting items there. I got to see some people I haven't seen in a long time. And it was just a typical National, and it was a typical what's a good way of putting it? A typical show of that nature, where you had a great blend of customers, of individuals going there. Many people just going for the box breaks. Many people just going for the autograph guests, and many hardcore collectors trying to find a couple cards for their collection, type of thing.
Yeah, and I listened to the show. Oddly enough, Captain, I listened to your show. And I loved your show. It was missing that comedic sidekick, but it was a good show.
it was tough talking 3 minutes straight. That's all I can say. But
I
did it.
And it was you've mentioned this before. You're like, there's a lack of vintage, and a lack of raw vintage. Football. We've tossed it around before. We think football represents about 10% of the hobby. And, a dealer once told me, he goes, he thinks that footballers tend to hang on to their stuff a lot longer. Al Crisafulli said this. He's like, footballers tend to hang on to stuff. A baseball collector, if they want to buy something, they will sell something to make room for that. But footballers tend to hang on to stuff a lot longer. So, and I've nothing to base that off of other than, somebody who's been in the industry and been, exposed to that a lot more than I have, but it makes sense because I don't sell a lot of stuff unless I decide to move on from something. I tend to, that's an amazing piece. Let me rustle up some money to get it,
you
talk about the National.
You bring up an excellent point, and I was going to relate this to my basically 4-day conversation with Mike Blaisdell there, and the historical perspective of his collection coming to auction is just incredible. And I can't stress it enough. And talking to several very advanced collectors out there, they understood what I was saying. I said, this is a once-in-a-lifetime collection that's coming to market. And if you're looking for something, he probably has it, number one. And number two, I would venture to say you're going to bid against 3 or 4 other people who need that to complete their collection. And because of that, it will make the auction even more, in my opinion, spectacular from a football hobby collection, football hobby perspective.
Not enough.
That it's just going to be some amazing pieces that are coming to the market. And it's a once-in-a-lifetime deal. I really believe that.
Not enough. Yeah, you talked, during your intro to the show, you talked about sponsored by, BST, MSB, and one of the I just got the email tickler for for the upcoming auction, and on the on the email is that 1926 Spalding the Shotwell picture card with the rare number 77 Red Grange in uniform card, 2 known examples. And most of us know where the other example is, going anywhere anytime soon.
Right. Yeah, I mean, amazing to me that the pieces are going to be coming up for auction. And the other comment, I have to parallel with the National. Now, I did get a chance to walk around several times through the course of the show. And as anyone who knows me know, I always look for oddball items. And I know Jeff Payne was out for a couple of days there, and I know he was scouting for the oddball stuff, and he would, tell me what I was, tell me where some stuff was, so on and so forth. I was just amazed at really the lack of oddball stuff on the floor, and it was few and far between, and at the same time it was few and far between, I was truly amazed to see the true – what's a good word to use? The true difficulty in trying to find the, let's say, Fairmont Sheets dairy cutouts.
Yeah.
Only two dealers had it. And again, for a lot of the collectors who were looking for it, and I'm sure there was probably, I would say realistically, 8 or 9 collectors looking for those cards. Most of those cards are cards they had already. And, you know, that's a tough find. And in my case, Brenda was with me. She was looking from dealer to dealer for my 1894 Mayos. And I couldn't find anything that I needed for my collection. And I thought that was amazing. That's the first national I've ever been to. Where
without
I'm
bad.
Down to so, you know, a handful of cards, and I can't find them. Obviously, Dunlop, you know, is number one on my want list, but I wasn't expecting to see it there. But a few other ones,
well,
I really thought I was going to pick up, and there was nothing there. You know?
First of all, Bob, I'm proud of you for not calling it a Mayo anymore. You know, we've cured you of that. You know, in 6 years of shows.
The
1894
Mayo cup one.
And I used to make fun of you incessantly about that. Oregon and Mayo.
I updated my views to Mayo. So, but in any event, it's just to me.
That's surprising.
I was very, very surprised not to see. Although there were some on the floor, and if anyone who knows me knows how I detest graded cards. I am putting that set together in SGC 2030. I did see a lot more PSA graded ones. However, they were the ones I had already. If there was a PSA graded one, which I felt was in that area of 20 to 30 SGC crossover, I would have bought it and then popped it out and crossed it over, much to the chagrin of many dealers who I mentioned that to. But I just feel that the SGC background is a lot nicer than the PSA clear plastic.
Without
it doesn't do anything for the card whatsoever.
Without a doubt. No, totally. I don't know what I also have a couple of SGC holders that have broken on me recently, and left a very, very old card floating around, you know, inside a slab. So, mm-hmm. I've never had a PSA slab break on me, but. Yeah, it's interesting, but they look a lot better, you know, in the SGC slab. There's no doubt about it.
Right. So that's the only reason why I'm collecting it in that particular holder. So,
surprised me. No Mayos, not a one.
Yeah, I mean I could not cross over. In other words, have a mix of PSAs and SGCs. They all have to be SGCs, and I'm obviously assuming my last card is going to be the Dunlop whenever I find it. I'm still hoping to find it at a tag sale here locally, since there were Ivy League teams. I'm just waiting to go to the proverbial tag sale and open up the cheese box and see them in there. And the person with the cheese box said, give me $20 for them. They're yours. I ain't got to get rid of them. If not, I'm going to put them to the curb and into the garbage. All right, so that was a real quick overview as far as the national. And again, I am pleased. I saw the numbers of people who listened to the show, so several people did comment afterwards stating they were very happy that I did give them a report live from the show. And unfortunately, due to technical difficulties beyond my control, I was not able to do that second show on Saturday. So here we are now, about a month out from the national. Next year's nationals in Cleveland should be interesting. Very difficult.
I will 100% be there.
Very
100% be here.
Very difficult show to get to if you're staying anywhere except right next to the, I think it's the Sheridan that's attached to the convention center there. So it should be interesting what happens. I am planning on staying downtown Cleveland. I'm not going to do what I did last time. It was just not conducive to a big show, to say the least. But looking at that, viewing that was a national. On a more serious note, we had talked very briefly about this before. I'm very upset, Joe, with the NFL. and I'm not going to hide my anger, my being upset. I am really, really tired of the kneeling, sitting down through the national anthem. And I'm just going to make 2 points on it, and then I'll open it up to you. Number one, whether these guys like it or not, and whether these guys are trying to be sociologists or whatever, they're employed by the NFL, the individual team of the NFL. That team is their employer, whether they want to believe it or not. And they need to follow what guidelines that they are given and perimeters they're given from the first day they walk into that camp. And I know damn well when they walk into that camp, they have probably a 300-400-page book they got to go through on what you're supposed to do and how you're supposed to act and how you're supposed to dress as a National Football League player. And I know for a fact, too, one part of that is you stand during the national anthem. And it really, 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 I hate to say it, bothers me to the point that I've talked to several people. I am going to write something for the fall issue of GG on it. It's just, it is what it is. I do not like it. And, again, you can't change history. History is what our country is based upon. If you're really upset about something, then work to change whatever is upsetting you. And you don't make change by violently crashing into or ruining statues that have been in existence for 200 or 300 years. That's something the Taliban did and does. That's something that we should not see in America. All right, I throw it to you.
Yeah. Two issues there that you're getting into. One is silent protesting, and the other one is, you know, tearing down a statue. The silent protesting. Obviously, I'm ex-Navy, so there's a certain amount of, you know, patriotism that goes with the national anthem. It upsets me to see people keep their hat on during the national anthem. It upsets me, you know, to see people disrespecting that. That being said, you know, my minor in college was American history with a focus on, you know, the Revolutionary era. I also believe in people's rights. And, you know, one of people's rights is to peacefully protest, you know, or, you know, peacefully assemble, you know, and, but those are your rights to the government. Those aren't your rights to your, you know, you don't have an employer bill of rights. You have a government bill of rights. If you are an NFL player, you are an employee for the team. And I own an intellectual company, so I have, you know, nearly 50 employees. Those employees are representing me and my values of my company when they go out and do their work. If somebody does something that flies in the face of those values, they've got a right to do that, but I've got a right to terminate their employment. So
Correct.
Colin Kaepernick has the rights to do whatever he wants to do on his own time. He can hold a press conference. He can, he can have his publicist say something. He can go march at a rally. He can do whatever he wants on his own time. I'm with you lockstep on that, Captain. The national anthem of an NFL game while you are being, you know, played, employed, is not the forum. I mean, and obviously, Colin Kaepernick holding a news conference doesn't get the airplay that taking a knee does. So that's why he's choosing it. So, you know, Colin Kaepernick has the right to do whatever he wants to do on his own time. When he takes the field, when he hits the stadium, puts on the pads, he is an employee. And as an employer, you know, any team has the right to terminate that employee. During a game is not the time. I would agree with you.
And again, is he that great of a quarterback that he should be playing is another question I have, or is it just because he's the spokesperson for this protest movement, and therefore he needs to play? And then you got people on both sides of the boycotting, people like myself. If these guys are going to sit during the anthem, I'm not going to watch the game. And I got the other side of people. Well, if they're not gonna take a knee, and they're not going to be listened to, I'm not watching the game. So the NFL really has, in my opinion, a public relations disaster on their hands right now. I really don't. I'm not hearing any response other than what Dallas Cowboys owner
Jerry Jones.
Stating. And, you know, and I agree with what he's saying. I mean, I'm glad he's making a stand. I'm glad he's saying what he's saying. And he has every right to. He owns that team. That's simple.
Yeah.
You know?
And he employs people. I'd be curious to see if a Dallas Cowboy player took a knee, if Jerry Jones would fire that person. Now, there's personal conduct, you know, clauses in every NFL contract.
Right.
If somebody gets arrested for abuse, now it's pretty standard in the personal conduct policy. That person gets released from the team without terminated in the NFL for personal misconduct, and they have guidelines around it. So I don't think taking a knee falls under personal misconduct. So I don't think somebody could be fired, but you could have, you know, your boss saying, I am not pleased with that person, et cetera. Michael Bennett, a Seattle Seahawks player, is taking a knee now also. And, you know, I there's an old saying, you know, as a military person, I respect your right, you know, to say what you want to say. I will die for that right, but that doesn't mean I have to listen to what you're saying. It's interesting.
And I think
Colin Kaepernick was a quarterback for the 49ers. Obviously, the 49ers are in the NFC West with the Seahawks, so I got to see Colin Kaepernick play twice a year. He was good. He had his problems, and you started to see the problems after the 49ers lost the NFC Championship to the Seahawks when they went on to win the Super Bowl that year. So you started to see the wheels fall off. He had games where he'd have, you know, three interceptions, you know, in a game, and so he got benched, and then he started protesting, and now he's gone. So you've got two things. Is Colin Kaepernick not getting a job because he's not a very good quarterback or because he's protesting? And it's both. It's come out.
Right.
You know,
there are
several teams who have had administrators say, he's not very good. We would probably give him a go as a backup quarterback. But the problem is, our coaches would be like, what are you doing handing me this guy? He's a distraction. There's a team-first mentality in the NFL. It's team-first. Next man up.
Right.
You know, team first.
Right.
Colin Kaepernick first, then you fly in the face of the team first culture that it belongs to an NFL team.
Correct. I agree with you. All right. We've got to move on because our guest is ready, and I can't wait to talk to him. Our guest tonight, who I ran into and met for the first time at the National, is a very long time subscriber to Gridiron Greats magazine. He's going to be featured in the fall issue as our Green Bay Packers super collector. And he hails from Wisconsin. And I'd like to introduce Mr. Scott Walter. Scott, welcome to the show tonight. Hey,
thanks for having me. How are you guys doing?
Very good. Very good.
Thanks for being on the show, Scott.
Very nice. I'm sorry?
Yeah, no, I think it was great to see you again at the National, Bob, and had a good conversation there.
Okay.
And, I echo a lot of things you said about the National finding those oddball items.
Great. Yeah, it was good. It was nice talking to you. I'm glad we were able to hook up. And I want to start off by asking you, how did you become a collector of Green Bay Packers memorabilia?
You know what? I think just growing up, like anybody else, I collected a lot of baseball cards and was into cards for quite a while. You know, I remember scrounging the change between the couch cushions we had a card shop probably a couple miles away from us, and, you know, always taking the change and trying to buy that new pack of cards. And I think that was a time, too, and it was interesting in the hobby because there was really only Topps and Flair and Dunruss. And then I know things changed. Upper Deck came on the scene, and the packs got more expensive and more expensive. You know, Leaf came out, and I think it turned me off a little bit on cards. And I think after a little bit of high school, started going to flea markets and whatnot, and I had been a Packer fan like anybody else growing up in Wisconsin and fell in love with the story of the team, the connection with the fans and anybody else. And, you know, there were some lean years in there in the 80s, but kind of was religious watching them in the 80s. You know, I remember the Monday night Bears game from 82 or 83. When, that was not a good game, but the cardiac back in 89. And just kind of fell in love, you know, with the Packers. I was watching them as, you know, a young boy growing up. And then at the same time, kind of lost my interest in cards, went to a flea market, and found this old Ray Nitschke Packers pin, a We Love Ray pin from a fan appreciation day that they did in, I think, 71 for Ray to kind of celebrate his career. Bought it.
Right.
And ever since then, I was hooked. It kind of connected my two passions, my collecting and the Packers. And ever since then, I was hooked.
Wow.
That's
and,
cool.
And anybody, and I say this all the time, I've been to Green Bay several times. I've been to other stadiums throughout the country. There is nothing the Green Bay Packers game experience, especially game day, to go to any of the pregame parties and places you can go eat and so on and so forth. It's just an incredible, incredible experience. And I know I've said this before in the past, but I gotta say it one more time. The first game my wife and I attended, we're saying, well, gee, you know, we're used to New York where you, you know, it takes you
sure.
4 hours to get home, which should be an hour
yep,
and a half
yep.
ride because the traffic is all bad. So I said to my wife, I said, well, let's just stand here and let's look at the traffic and see how bad it was. We had a rental car, and we were going to go to Fuzzy's afterwards because I wanted to meet
sure.
him. I heard he was there and, you know, have a drink over there, and then we'll head back to the hotel. So we're leaving, and we never saw, like, 50,000 people orderly walk out of a stadium, get in their vehicles, actually stop at stoplights and go on green lights and allow people to cross the streets. We never
sure.
saw anything like that. We're like just standing there in awe, you know, wondering.
Yeah.
We've never seen anything like this before. This is
yeah,
amazing.
Yeah.
And,
you know, and I would echo
you know,
that.
That
a few. Oh, go ahead.
And then I asked directions to Fuzzy's. I got it. And then a fellow said, well, just follow me. I'm going to go there. And I said, I'll buy you a drink. He said, no, you're from Connecticut. I'm going to buy you guys a drink for being the, you
yeah.
know, I'm a
wow.
local.
And, yeah, we had a similar experience.
Meet Fuzzy and picture with him. It was truly, what an amazing experience. What an amazing
mm-hmm,
experience.
Mm-hmm.
It's just incredible.
Yeah. We had a similar experience a few years ago. We have friends that live in L.A., and he came up, and I took him to his first Packers game, you know, and he just could not believe it. Here's this stadium. You know, he's used to Los Angeles, but here's this stadium in Green Bay that's literally plopped down in the middle of a neighborhood. There's houses
right,
all around it.
Right.
And we park
yep,
our car. We're walking to the stadium. A gentleman offers him an adult beverage, you know, for free. Just he knew he – it's just amazing. It's just – it's a different experience. And I honestly – I know it sounds kind of corny, but I get the chills every time I go to Green Bay. I remember the first time going to Green Bay and seeing that big receiver statue standing outside the Hall of Fame for the first time. But it's just
yep. –
it's an incredible experience. Yeah.
It is.
Yep.
It is. It's just truly
well,
amazing.
Well, as a Seahawks fan, even I recognize that Lambeau Field is the mecca of football. So one of these days, I will one of these days I will make the pilgrimage to Mecca, and I will kneel at the
there
Coliseum that you know that the Super Bowl trophy Lombardi isn't named after. So
there
Lombardi
you go.
Field.
Yeah.
all right, you're gonna hear it first here. When Joe goes to Green Bay, Brenda and I will go out there and meet him. And whoever he's with.
I'm always respectful. I'm always respectful. My goal is to have a picture of me standing in front of every NFL stadium wearing a Steve Largent jersey.
Wow, nice.
I've got about 10 of them down right now.
Wow.
But, you know, had a couple kids in between, you know, business gets in the way. It's been about 3 years since I've been to one.
Yeah.
But some pretty memorable ones. I went to you know, Chicago, you know, to Soldier Stadium with you know, with Andy Becker from BST, crashed
yeah,
at his house
yeah.
for a couple of days. And he and I took
yeah.
a rickshaw to the game. I talked him into getting into a rickshaw with me. And Andy Becker is no small guy. If you can imagine, he and I squeezed into a rickshaw getting dropped off in front of Soldier Field with, you know, everybody looking at us. So,
sure.
Poor Andy. I embarrassed him for life. But I've got a couple questions. I mean, everybody's got a couple of, you know, their top items. And sometimes
sure.
that item is, you know, value. Sometimes it's, you know, sentimental.
Yep.
You know, I'm sure you've got a, you know, gently game used Brett Favre jockstrap in your collection, but what are your top five items in your collection that you
I do
love?
Have a pair of his gently used socks, but I do not have the jockstrap.
Oh. Okay.
Yes.
You can call yourself a fan?
I'm sorry, what?
You call yourself a fan?
Yeah, exactly. Nice. No, I'm not sure where to start, to be honest with you. You know, I think the best thing about collecting is there's just so many different oddball items and variations of things that I really truly love them all. And I think, you know, most of my shrine is in my basement, and I truly love going down there. And I think, like most collectors too, you run out of space pretty quick. So I think I tend to rotate things in and out, or find things that I didn't know that I had anymore. But I think my favorite probably is I have a practice worn Vince Lombardi jacket. I'm the fourth owner of it. It came from his secretary. So, and I think what I like about it the most of the pictures that you see of Vince, you see him in that green jacket with the script Green Bay Packers lettering on. And that's the jacket. So that's pretty cool. That's one of my favorites.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. I think when I picked
up, how do you have that displayed? If you don't mind,
To be honest with you, I have it. That's when I put away and bring out from time to time, just on the stand. I haven't framed it because I don't really want to frame it, to be honest with you. You know, I kind of like displaying the whole jacket. I'd like to find a big like shadow box or something to put that in. But I have just oddball stuff. I have a 1915 Green Bay East yearbook that has. It's not Curley's yearbook, but he was a sophomore in it. It has a lot of pictures of him playing football. You know, and on the Curly Lambeau on the track team, and he's pictured kind of, there's a solo picture of him, a track picture. So that's kind of cool. And, you know, right after Green Bay East, he went on to spend a fall in Notre Dame, and then the rest is kind of green and gold history when he came back home.
Yeah.
Leading down to the basement, I have, one of the old admission signs from the original Green Bay Packers Hall of Fame when it was first, built. There's only one of two signs, and it's kind of leading down to my basement. It's a big sign. It has the old Packer helmet and all the admission prices for kids and adults, and that's kind of a neat piece.
Oh, that's cool.
Kind of a one-of-a-kind.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Unbelievable.
You know, you've seen the pictures of the big felt Title Town banners that used to hang on the businesses in the 60s during one of the championship parades. I have one of those kind of up in my basement. I think my neatest piece that I picked up about a year ago that I'm still kind of doing research on is I have a carbon copy of the Articles of Incorporation for the Packers that they were filed. It has the date that they were filed. They were filed in January something in 1935, and it kind of outlines how the organization will be set up at that time after that stock sale. And it was filed by three members of the original Hungry Five, who kind of led the Packers through their lean years in the 20s and 30s. I have some correspondence on Packers letterhead from the mid 1940s between those guys as well. And I love, again, that's where I rotate things in and out. I love looking at some of the old logos, and I have a lot of old, stationery and whatnot with a lot of, it's interesting to see how the colors change and the logos change throughout time of teams. And I love looking at that.
You know what's fascinating, Scott? Not one of those items you mentioned is a football card.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Yeah. I know, and that's what I said. I've kind of lost interest in cards. There's so many neat oddball items out there that I like looking at.
Without a doubt, So where's that Ray? Ray Nitschke.
It is still displayed. I have on one of the shelves downstairs. I have a case with, or a couple cases with a lot of the pins and stuff. It's still there, the original pin. And that's I think I was telling you about with the National. I do buy and sell a little bit, but I will only sell my duplicates. Mm-hmm. I don't sell my originals. But basically, the theory is that if I find, you know, enough duplicates, I can increase my own collection for free, or at least that's what I tell myself. It maybe doesn't work out that way. Probably spend more money than that I make. But you know how that is.
I love it.
Yeah, I mean, again, if we all had an infinite amount of money, we theoretically could buy everything that we wanted. But then is it everything we really want? And, you know, the amazing part about your collection, Scott, and looking at the photos you sent me, which are going to be in the upcoming issue of Gridiron Greats, I mean, the stuff is just—it's just mind-boggling to me. And I say to myself, you know, I can see why individuals don't really need to collect football cards. You know what I mean? Because there's so much stuff out there.
Oh my goodness! Yeah,
it's just amazing.
Yeah.
You know, and there's so many different peripheral items that you can collect,
yes,
paper items, so on and so forth. It
yes,
just truly amazes me. It truly amazes me.
Yeah, and I know you were kidding me about the jockstrap, but I just started getting into game used stuff a couple years ago, and I'd never been into that, but that's a huge market in and of itself.
Right. Right.
I'll confess to you, Scott, I don't own a Steve Largent jockstrap either, so very good company.
Nice.
I'm glad, Joe, you don't. But
even I have a line that gets drawn between being a fan and being weird.
Exactly.
Scott, do you have any memorable collecting stories you'd like to share with our listening audience?
You know what, I was trying to think about this. You know what, I think everybody has stories of the quote unquote the find, and I think I've made a couple of those good finds. I mean, I think once back in the 60s, Mobil, the gas station company, came out with these Packer prints. It was a set of 8 prints in these big envelopes, and
yeah,
I came across one set, a rummage, a big box of, like, there's 8 in a set, and I came across there had to be at least 50 to 60 sets in there. So that was kind of, you know, like a dime. I think it was like a dime a piece, but I think I paid like maybe $10 for the whole box. I think '90s, the Packers Pro Shop used to have a tent sale. Came across a pair of Brett Favre game used pants. Now it's jockstrap again, but the game used pants, just in a box of pants, which is kind of cool with the number 4, and they showed game use. I think one of my favorite memories, however, just happened this last spring. It was a game used item, but you know, now I think I get the joy of being a dad and seeing my son get a little interested in it. We happen to be up in Green Bay at the pro shop and just kind of bumming around. And one of the managers kind of came up and started talking to my son, asking us where we were from, et cetera, who his favorite player was. And behind his back, he pulled out a pair of these practice pants and gave them to my son. And he kind of looked at me, and I noticed the tag right away. It had the logo inside and the 12, and Aaron it had said Rodgers. And my son Alex said, you know, thank you at first, like he should. But he didn't really get the tagging and whose they were. And then, you know, the manager prodded him to look a little further on the inside. And once he realized that they were Aaron Rodgers' pants, I mean, he was on a high for weeks. And, yeah, a little hole in the knee. You know, they definitely had some practice use. But that was pretty cool, I think, to see my son, you know, have that joy as well. And I think I've just, you know, I've met great people along the way. I think one of my favorite stories is just, you know, talking to some of the players. I think I make the pilgrimage up to training camp every year too. I think that's why Bob, I couldn't be on the earlier show because I was at training camp. But it was the summer of, I think, 94, 95. And after practice, I drove over to St. Norbert's, where the players kind of hang out in the dorms afterwards and where they live during training camp. And I was just walking around campus, and Brett Favre parked his truck and pulls up, T-shirt and shorts, and he's carrying this TV and looks at me. He says, "How's it going?" And I said, good, Mr. Favre, how are you? And I asked him if he wouldn't mind, you know, I had a couple things. Would you mind signing something? He said, "Absolutely. Just let me take this up." So he takes this TV out of his truck, takes it up, must place it. He comes back down 10 minutes later and talks to me for about 10 minutes, signs some newspapers that I have, you know, with him on the cover, and just a nice guy. I mean, that's before, you know, he became, you know, like Mr. NFL at the time. But, yeah, just I think that kind of stuff. Bart Starr, I've had many, many good Bart Starr encounters. Just a genuine class act, and truly. Just a lot of good stories like that, of just meeting people.
That's great.
Speaking of Bart Starr, did you see that 1957, you know, Topps Bart Starr rookie card, you know, that just sold at auction?
No, I didn't. No.
It wasn't the rookie card, excuse me. It was the, you know, the original artwork from it.
Really?
Yeah.
Was that the MSB? Or, excuse me, BSD? Was that them? Or who was that sold that, Captain?
I think it was.
Yeah.
I didn't follow it closely enough, but I know what you're talking about. I think it might have been them.
Wow.
But, original artwork. Current want list. What are you looking for? I mean, I would imagine some Packers, Walkers, Cleaners sets are on that want list.
I would love actually to have those. Those would definitely be on my want list. I'll be honest in saying I do not have any of those. you know, I said I'm branching into the older game used items. I would love, you know, I don't know if you've ever seen like the blue and gold capes from the 50s, early 60s that the players wore on the sideline. I do not have one of those, but those are really sharp looking. But really, I'm interested in, you know, any buttons, pins, glasses, pennants, anything really oddball. I always tell people when I run into them, if it's green and gold, I'll buy it. So, yeah, just anything oddball.
I got a
seriously, or a Packer Walker cleaner set on your want list?
I would love it. I don't know if my wife would have it on my want list based on how much they cost. But.
Scott, I got a question a little off the script here with regards to a want list. In your travels, and I like Packer programs. I do have a pretty big collection of them, although I have very few pre-1940. And you're, you know, obviously in the heart of Packerland there. How difficult are earlier Packer programs, let's say, you know, basically 1919 up to World War II? What's your take on it? What are your feelings on it as far as how difficult or how plentiful they may be?
I think, you know, you're going to find stuff, you know, from the 30s, I think they're around, and occasionally I'll see them on eBay, you're going to pay market value for those.
Right.
From the upper 30s, early 40s. Lower 30s, they're not, you don't run across them too much in 20s even. I mean, you're going to pay a pretty penny for them. I mean, there was a time, I mean, when I started collecting, you know, in the mid to late 90s, I mean, they were out there, and the Green Bay Packer Bulletin, you know, those, when they produced those were out there. I mean, there were people that told stories about finding boxes of them at that time and for nothing. And I probably could have had them if I would have looked hard enough. I didn't, you know, you kick yourself now, but you're doing this 20 years and you learn. But, I don't think they're very plentiful. And if they are, I mean, you're going to pay for them, and they come across at auctions and things, but, to put together a, you know, a nice run of them, would cost a pretty penny.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of figured that. I was just curious, and the few times the times I've been up to Green Bay and Wisconsin there, and I've actually had the time to travel, I've hit a lot of different antique shops up there, trying like every other person who goes there to Wisconsin, try to find something. And a gentleman in, it was like a co-op's shop, I don't remember the town it was, he told me straight out, he if he gets any 1920s or 1930s programs, they're sold immediately, and it's at his price, and no questions asked whatsoever. But I was just curious if there's any difference in seeing it there as compared to a show or whatever. I know this show,
a couple
older programs, but nothing of any of great rarity or whatever. You know, I saw a few from the 40s.
And that really changed. I mean, I distinctly remember when it changed. I mean, even at shows, I mean, me doing shows, I've been doing shows, you know, as a dealer myself for quite some time too. But when the Packers won, I call it the first Super Bowl, not the first, the first Super Bowl of my era in 96.
Right.
Even when you talk about going to antique malls and everything, prices jumped dramatically. You know, even people that didn't know a lot about it, if it had a G on it, they would mark it up tremendously, especially being in Wisconsin.
Right.
It's harder to track that stuff down now at a reasonable price.
Yeah, I can imagine that too. And then the other question off the script a little, the Packer yearbook, obviously 1960 is the treasured one, although I've been seeing more and more come to the market over the past few years. In your opinion, what's a fair price for that? For that yearbook, I mean, I've seen it anywhere from $300 all the way up to $1,000, and I'm just looking for like a readable copy of it. So, what do you think I should pay based on that?
I mean, obviously, the cover and the binding make the difference. If you're looking for a readable copy and you don't care if the cover is a little beat up and whatnot, I think you know, I've seen them for as low as $300 with a clean cover. You know, out here, and I know our prices probably are not, I know if you go out east or down Chicago, they're a little bit more. Out here, I've seen them for, you know, $600-$700, you know, on what people would consider, you know, pretty pristine condition. Yeah, so that's pretty much the range.
Could you guys elaborate on why the 1960 program is so important? I mean, we have some listeners and some Seahawk fans who aren't quite aware of why that. So
it's
why the 1960
it's the
program?
First, yeah, it's the first yearbook in the run, which became, you know, it's been one of the longest continuous running yearbooks of any team for that, you know, 1960 to now, and it's the first in the run of them.
Oh, okay. Oh, okay.
Yeah, they are the longest issuing team in the NFL publishing a yearbook. So
yeah.
From 1960 through now, the current issue 2017, which I know is out, they have a complete run. And for me, the only issue that I'm missing is the 1960 one. I didn't pull the trigger on one I saw at the National. I thought it was a little high. And
sure.
It was in very nice condition. But, you know, I'm going to go home, and one night before I go to bed, I'm going to read it.
Right, exactly.
And, you know,
absolutely.
I'm not gonna have white gloves on while I'm reading it, type of thing. And you know, the cat may jump on me while I'm reading it, type of thing. Also, so I gotta, you know, I'm more looking for a readable issue. And as such, to say, I do have every issue of the yearbook. I do love their yearbooks. They're very, very well done, very nicely written, very complete. They're really nice to read. And the 60s ones, from 60 to 69, they're beautifully done. The photography is incredible.
They are. Yeah, you're right. You're right.
About 5 years ago, the NFL came out with the most rabid fan list. And it was based on sales of, you know, team memorabilia, et cetera. And, you know, they're the Steelers, the Pittsburgh Steelers, Dallas Cowboys, the Chicago Bears, Green Bay Packers, and the Oakland Raiders was the one that, you know, made me raise an eyebrow on that list. You know, but yeah, so it's not hard to imagine why that stuff is scarfed up, you know, that very rare and you know, you've got ravenous, zealous fans who just love anything vintage Green Bay.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, you know, definitely, especially with the Packers, the richness of their history just makes it so appealing to collect. And to know that, you know, especially if you're a shareholder on top of it makes me even more proud of it. And, you know, that's part of the excitement to me of being a Packer fan and a Packer collector, even though I'm stuck in Wallingford, Connecticut here. So, it's something, too, as an aside, going back to that first visit to Fuzzy's over there, and when I met Fuzzy, and he asked, you know, where we came from, and I said, Wallingford, Connecticut. And he was generally... not surprised, but he was just so happy to hear that we were from Connecticut. And I told him about my liking about Sharansky growing up in the 60s, and he got all excited when he heard that. And he told me a few stories about Sharansky, and because he grew up locally here and he played football here locally. And the New Haven papers used to cover him religiously because he was a local boy that made good with the Packers. The Packers were winning. So on and so forth. It's just a great storyline, to say the least. I mean, just
absolutely.
Incredible.
Absolutely, and that's why I think, you know, and every team has their stories and their characters, but I think the Packers just have so many, and then when you talk about collecting, there's different items that, you know, the team didn't necessarily produce, but they go along with those stories and they go along with those characters. You know, like I'm talking about those articles of incorporation that I have. You know, this team almost folded, you know, and that they in the 30s, 40s, there were many times that they almost folded and we wouldn't be talking about it today.
Right.
So, and there's just all different kinds of items that go along with the stories. And so, it's truly rich history.
Yeah, it's an amazing story that I truly wish the NFL would, what's a good word for it, respect it a little more than what it does. And I know it's a sore spot for them because you're in such a small market. But you don't realize you're one of three America's teams out there, you know, because you have fans throughout the world who are Packer fans, you know, that's
absolutely
the situation.
And,
you know, and you can't begrudge them because that stadium is in the middle of a residential neighborhood and you park on people's lawns for $10 and use their bathrooms before you go to the game, type of thing, you know, that kind of thing. And I've had that happen to me a few times. And coming back from the game, the woman's house, she says, I got food in there. Go to the bathroom before you get in the car. Eat some stuff and get home safe, type of thing. And we're like, Brenda and I are looking at each other. I said, this can't be real. Because, you know, do you go to a game, go to a Giants game here or a Jets game, you know, you want to run to your car and lock yourself in the car. And you know, get out of there, type of thing. You know, it's just truly amazing. Scott, I got another question for you. Do
sure.
you have any advice for a beginning collector? Somebody's listening tonight and they're saying, wow, I want to collect my Packers, I want to collect my Cowboys or Seahawks or whatever my favorite team or college team, whatever the case might be. You have any advice?
I think with anything else, you know, start small. We talked about there's so many different avenues you can go down, so I guess I would pick one avenue first, and I guess my overall advice would be to enjoy the hunt. You know, I can't. There's just so many. You never know what you're going to go find. When you go to an antique mall or flea market or anything else, I mean, pardon me, it sounds kind of corny again, but you get on the high when you find the item, and there's an anticipation there and to enjoy that. And, you know, sometimes you just can't have a list. You got to look around, and you just don't know what you're going to find. I think what also is important to the more you can network. You know, I've met so many other great collectors, and then as you meet people, you learn more about, you know, some stories that they have about items or the history of items, and then you get into the history of the team. So the more you network, the more information you get, too. So I guess those would be my pieces of advice.
It's amazing. And, you know, it's funny when you say it's the thrill of the hunt. Brenda and I, my wife and I, go to a lot of tag sales here locally. And, you know, a lot of them are, you know, they're just people clearing their house out. So we go to this brand-new condo complex. And there was a condo for sale, and the guy had all his stuff on the driveway. And my wife says, I'm sitting in the car. You go out there. So I go out there, and I'm looking, and I see this box. And it's filled with 1960s New York Giant programs, yearbooks, and stuff. And I'm looking through it. And I'm saying, no, it can't be. And the guy says, do you want that box? I said, well, what are you asking for? He said, well, how about $20? I said, that's very, very fair. I mean, obviously, you know, I'm gonna work it. I'll make some money on it. But I said to him, how did you ever, you know, you're a young guy. How did you ever come upon this? And he said it was my uncle's, and I've been carrying it for like, 25-30 years now. And he says, I really want to get rid of it. Next step, I'm going to throw it in the garbage. And I said, you know, you got a lot of nice 1960 stuff here. I mean, and he said, yeah, that's what other people said, but I don't want to be bothered with it. And that's it. I was floored, and I go back to the car, and Brenda says to me, "What'd you buy now?" And I showed her, and she said, "Oh my gosh, how could you? You know, you would never think from this condo complex that you would find something like that." And that's why the hunt is half the fun.
It is. You're absolutely right.
Stuff. It's just truly amazing, and it's true. And if you actually have fun with it, you can really enjoy your collection.
Yeah.
All right, Scott,
absolutely.
Any other final thoughts? We're running out of time here.
No, I just appreciate the conversation, guys, and appreciate the opportunity. And it was good. It's fun. It's fun to talk about these things.
Yeah. I loved your story about either. Everybody's got a story about what kickstarted them back into the hobby.
I loved
your Ray Nitschke pin story. I collected most of my, you know, youth life, and then in 1999, my sister gave me an autographed Steve Largent card for Christmas, and the rest is history.
There you go. Yeah, exactly.
One of my most valuable cards is this.
Yeah.
Worthless Steve Largent autographed card. It's not even his rookie card.
Funny.
That is. It's just the card that got me back into the hobby. And
absolutely.
Thoughtful gifts somebody's ever given.
Absolutely.
You know.
Yeah.
That's the fun of our hobby, to say the least. It's one spark that brings you to this journey. Truly amazing. Well, Scott, thank you very much for being on the show. Hopefully we'll run in together, and I'm going to give you a call next time I'm in Green Bay.
That sounds good. I would take you up on it. Hey, you can come over to the shrine.
I'm going to take you up on looking at the museum there.
All right, that sounds good.
All right, Scott, thank you.
Take care, guys.
Scott Walter.
All right, thank you.
Green
okay, yeah, take care.
Super court.
Super
thank collector
you. Bye-bye.
For the fall issue. Unbelievable collection. I was so happy to run into him at the National. And again, I want to remind everybody, check out MSB Sports Cards, their website, MSBSportsCards.com, and look into that new fall upcoming auction with BST Auctions, BSTAuctions.com. Joe, that was just, boy. I'm literally speechless after hearing his stuff and seeing the stuff, and I know a lot of our readers are going to be really interested in that article in the fall issue.
Yeah,
he has some amazing stuff. Amazing stuff. Truly amazing stuff.
So did you run into him at the National?
Yeah, he comes up to me and he says, "You're Bob Swick." And I said, "Yes, I am." I said, I don't know who you are. And he said, "I'm Scott Walter." And I recognize his name as being a subscriber. I also recognize he's a very big Packer collector. And we ended up talking for probably 45 minutes there. And I said, "I got to have you on the show." And we were talking about the super collector, and he agreed to be it. And we took it from there. So I was very pleased. And Scott is one of the original subscribers to Gridiron Greats also. So he's been with the magazine for many, many years. But I knew of Scott's collecting items way back when, because he was a big Packer, you know, looking for Packer stuff, so on and so forth. And then, you know, that's the nice part about this hobby. I know I've been in it for a couple hundred years now, but, you know, the people I know, and then not remembering names, but I always kind of remember what they collected. And that, to me, is just the pureness of this hobby that I've seen for so many years now. You know, I know the guy who's the Packer collector. I know the guy who's the Browns collector. I know the guy who's the big Cowboys collector. I know the guy who's the big Army-Navy collector, so on and so forth. And it's just there's so many of those types of collectors out there. That's what makes the hobby so rewarding. It's truly great. I mean, I can throw away all the commercialism of the hobby and continue to just enjoy and treasure the seeing those types of collections and talking to these people and interviewing them on their collection. And
yeah.
It truly amazes me. Truly amazes me.
You know, and even, you know, looking at your collection with Red Grange, to me, it's so amazing to see and to hear about. And it's so historical. It's just incredible. It's truly an incredible, incredible collection. And there's so many of those incredible collections out there, too. That's what I find so rewarding in the hobby, to
say
the
least. Thank you. I mean, I'll say it's humbling to have somebody like you, you know, compliment my collection. You know, thank you very much. You know, especially when, you know, we've got a Mike Blaisdell collection on the, you know, coming up on the hopper. You know, my stuff pales into comparison to the breadth and width of, you know, that collection. And just his knowledge of, you know, stuff. You know, he's been collecting for 15 years things, sets that I've never even heard of. So, I mean, that's
right.
You know, that's the humbleness of the whole thing.
Well, you know, I was telling Mike, you know, half kidding and half not kidding. I got a little choked up at the end of the show this year. And I normally don't, you know, I'm saying to myself, you know, it's time to get home. I want to get home, get into my own bed, so on and so forth. But this show, for whatever reason, you know, and spending a lot of time with Mike talking about things, it really kind of got to me. And I'm saying to myself, you know, I'm getting older. I'll be 60 next year already. You know, I've been doing this for a long, long time. And you know, I've seen a lot. I've seen a lot of trends. I've seen trends I don't like. I've seen trends I do like. And I think this show finally made me realize more than anything else, I just got to do what I find that is fun. I can't fight about the box breaks anymore. I'm not going to worry about whether people have a one-card collection. I'm not going to worry if they're just going to go to the show for an autograph. I'm not going to worry about anything anymore. And at the same time, I'm going to enjoy what anybody collects, being football, obviously. You know, whether they just do collect cards, whether they just do collect tenants, or whatever the case might be, I just let it ride. And I told Mike that while we were out there, and then I said, you know, I'm choked up because you know you're really slowing down in your collecting, and you know I think every collector reaches that point where they, you know, they got to wonder, okay, I don't want to drop dead tomorrow and then leave my collection for my wife to try to figure out what to do. You know, obviously. You know, Mike, myself, many other big collectors, they have a plan if, God forbid, anything happens. You know, this is what you got to follow. You know, I've talked to the people in advance already. You know, this is it, you know. So it is what it is. But I was a little choked up at the end of this National. And it was very meaningful for me. I'm glad I went. I'm glad Brenda came with me, too. And she even said she had a good time. And it was good. It was overall good. All right, we're down to a minute again. We'll be hopefully back, I'm assuming, within 2 weeks. I'm working on several guests for September, and we're going to have a few more shows. Joe, very good talking to you again, but you got to come to the National next year, whether you like it or not.
You can count on it, sir. I had a lot going on this year, you know, and it just ended up not working out. My wife's mother's health was the number one reason I couldn't make it.
Right. I fully understand that. All right, 30 seconds. We're wrapping it up again. Check out our website, GridironGreatsMagazine.com. We have back issue sales also. Fall issues will be out first week in October. And, Joe, we'll be talking. Thanks for listening.
Thank you very much, Captain. Till next time.
All right. Take care.
Da, 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 da. Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba.
Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Do you wish you knew more about the 100 seasons of the NFL? You're in luck because you found the Football History Dude podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. From the founding of the league in an auto showroom, all the way to what it is today, America's favorite sport and a behemoth of an industry. My name is Ernie Chapman. Football is my passion, and I want you to come along with me each week to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board my DeLorean and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.